So, well, I'll tell you what's happening with this project. I had started this some years ago. There was a very capable art history graduate student who did a lot of research, a huge amount of research in the Hunter College records about the former faculty. And, you know, a lot of people had always said, oh, we've had this illustrious faculty and no one has ever made any point about this. So she did a tremendous amount of research, and then she went and interviewed, do you remember the twins?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
The ladies. Yeah, what was that? I forgot their names.
Anna McKenna and Margaretha Miller.
That's right.
Who are alive and well,
really?
Living in Broxville,
oh,
age 93.
My love.
And she did a very long interview with them, and then the thing lay dormant for a while. And a couple of years ago, I thought, well, I would like to actually do this before I leave and retire myself. And I got some of the City University Research Foundation grant money to help pay for whatever just the expenses
trip
are.
Out to Locust Valley.
Yeah, exactly. So, and all of a sudden, there were 15 MA and MFA and alumni and a few stray, you know, an English department faculty person and so forth and so on, who were interested in this thing. And we started to, Leo Steinberg was interviewed, and someone managed to talk to Gene Goosen on the phone before he passed away, which was just this year, and so forth and so on. So suddenly, it also looks like we have a book on our hands, and we probably will be publishing in some form sooner or later. And I think that the idea is to give some life to this history that very few people know about, except those, of course, who have been there or have somehow chanced upon this.
Who are still left.
Or who are still left, yes. So.
I'm beginning to feel I'm the only survivor from my period.
No.
Most of the others are on still.
There are.
I don't know. The ones that I know mostly personally are gone.
So I'm going to start this officially now. Let's see. What is today? Today is the...
Page one.
Is the
I don't know.
Today is the 6th.
That's right.
So, this is George Hoffman on Friday morning, March 6th, speaking with Richard Lippold, American sculptor and former Hunter faculty member. So, you began teaching there in 1956. I found out. Did you know that?
You probably have all the information you need. I don't know why you came to talk to me.
I only know the bare bones.
56, you say?
I think so, yes. 56.
I think you're probably right, because we moved out here in 55.
Uh-huh.
And, well, it's vague to me now, but I remember commuting from here. You know,
oh, really?
To teach. Yeah, the Long Island Railroad.
And what were the what I was curious about? We were talking just a little bit about Edna Lutz. She was then the chair. And did you know her or have some previous contact with her?
No, I didn't. I didn't. What I understand from the history of the department is that it was quite moribund and she took it over.
Yes.
And with great vivacity, as we all know, the first thing she did when she became chairman, I don't know whether she had been teaching there, was a member of the department, and then the previous chairman, who I don't know, left office and she became chairman, immediately wanted to bring it up to date.
Yes.
First thing she did was to hire Robert Motherwell.
Yes.
And he and I knew each other fairly well. We'd exhibited together and so on. We were not intimate friends, but we knew each other very well. And she asked him to choose appropriate teachers to help develop the department, artists especially. Of course, he was in the art world so deeply. So the first person he suggested to augment the department was me, I guess that's right.
Mm-hmm.
And so I joined the faculty along with him. We were the only two there. Then,
oh, really?
Gradually, there were others, but I'm Ray Parker and
Baziotis.
Yeah, Baziotis, and who was a photographer, and Siskin came.
Ah, yes.
He was a nice guy. Very lively.
You know, no one has mentioned him so far to me. Only one. It just rings a slight bell. Was he well known at the time?
Oh,
I can't remember.
Well, you know, as we were all well known.
Well,
he wasn't very well.
You, of course, no, I think.
I mean, it wasn't a time for art much in this country, but anyhow.
Yeah.
Siskin was a very fine photographer. He did wonderful, wonderful things. And I don't remember who suggested him. Maybe I did, even for the department. I don't really remember. But anyhow, he joined the faculty, brought a lot of life to it, because any of the students loved him, because he was a very vivacious type. What are you looking at?
Just looking at, yes, the little wheel going around. So he was well-liked.
Yes, Aaron Siskin was very well-liked in the department and got on very well with the students. He was very lively, made jokes. He was a very natural kind of man and a good guy.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't remember whether it was I who proposed him or not, because we knew each other from other sources.
Mm-hmm.
We had his girlfriend and I were well acquainted, and I met him through her.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, I don't remember.
Actually, you know, you. I'm looking back here. I was wrong. It was 52 that you started there.
It was.
So it's further back. So it must have been shortly after Lutz came in. She must have hired Motherwell, and shortly thereafter, he must have recommended you.
Yes, I know that's the way. That was the sequence of events. I don't remember the dates.
Yeah.
We were still living in New York until 1955 when we moved out here to this very house.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I remember, first of all, just being in the city and teaching. Then after we moved, that's the way it was. After we moved out here, I had to commute. I didn't really want to at first, and said, "No, you really must stay with the department. I didn't want to let you go." So I commuted for a while.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know when I left. You remember what date I...
Well, you were there till 1967.
Yeah, well...
So that's a good long time, really.
By that, yes, it was a long time, and there was no reason for me to leave. I had a full professorship and tenure in her life. She gave me a very light teaching load. I ended up teaching only two nights a week, two graduate classes. And she was trying to hang on to me, but I was very, very busy with architectural commissions and the things I was involved with by that time.
Yeah.
I was traveling a great deal. I wasn't around a lot.
Yeah.
I would have to find a substitute teacher for my classes, and I began to feel I was very unfair to them.
Yeah.
So eventually I told Goosen I really had to leave, that I wasn't being fair to the students. I was 1 year from tenure. And
yeah.
I mean, so I'm left with none of that, but that's beside the point.
Oh, right.
And I didn't think I needed it then. I was earning a great deal by my commission, so I, you know, worked in a small amount every year. But that was beside the point. I enjoyed being there, and I regretted having to leave. Lucy tried to prevail upon me to stay, gave me every possible incentive, but
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel I could do it because I was away so much. I was traveling a great deal at that time. Anyhow, that's when I left and why I left. But I had no quarrel with the department or with your attitude toward me or with the school or anything. And I enjoyed the students. I made some very good friends among the students. And so it was out of necessity rather than wish, you know, desire.
Yeah. Since Goosen came around 63 or 4, you overlapped for a few years then, actually.
I don't remember how long he was. It wasn't very long.
No, it was not very long.
A couple of years, maybe.
Maybe it was a little later that he came, maybe even 65 or so.
I don't think.
Yeah, yeah. And then...
I know it wasn't very long. It couldn't have been more than 2 years that I stayed on when he became chairman.
Yeah, so maybe it was 65 that he came and you were...
And, it was another year in any event.
Yeah.
Well, it was a nice place to teach. I enjoyed it very much. I hope you do too if you're still there. It was very congenial, and the department was good. You know, mm-hmm. Edna had made a good thing of it. So it was a pleasure for me to teach there.
Yeah.
I taught for 15 years, I think, and under.
Yeah.
The longest teaching stint I had.
Yeah, I noticed that you had... been at Goddard, where you were head of the art department, actually.
I was the art department.
Oh, really? Is that so?
I was the only one teaching art.
Are you serious?
Yeah, but it was a very small college.
Yeah.
Total enrollment couldn't have been more than 50, 60 in the whole school. It was a very small school.
Oh, it could have been that tiny.
Well, it was very
really?
Small. Yeah.
Really?
Well, maybe it was a little more than that.
Big reputation.
Maybe 100, I might grant, but I... More than that. So I had six students.
Wow.
The first term I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And I made an assignment. I said, let's go for a walk. So we all went for a walk. And when we got back to the studio, I said, now I'd like you to draw something you observed on this walk. Anything at all, one of your thumbnails of something that you saw while you were up from. Three of the students said, we don't do that here. Nobody tells us what to do. We decide what we want to do, and then we do it, and that's how we learn. I said, well, what would you like to do? So one of the boys said, I want to do an oil portrait of my grandmother. I said, have you ever painted before? No, but that's how I learn. He may have been right.
Possibly.
Another one said, oh, he wanted to do a mural about the history of America. 90 feet by 30 feet or something. I said, where are you going to do this? Oh, we'll find a place around here somewhere, in the dining room or somewhere. So three of them had these outre for me ideas about what they wanted to do. And I said, well, okay, if you want to do them, you go and do them. And if you want any advice or any help or any suggestions or anything, let me know and I'll do it. So the three of them took off and never did anything. But I was left with three very, very devoted students. And they became lifelong friends. And they went for the walk and drew what they saw. And that's how we started out with that. It was kind of a wild place.
God, in college.
But it did introduce me to Vermont. And I fell in love with Vermont. And shortly after that, I bought some property. And we have a house up there.
Uh-huh.
I adore it. It's really such a beautiful part of the world.
Where?
It hasn't changed. I look out for, you know, we have a porch looking out over a great landscape, including the White Mountains and Vermont of New Hampshire. And it hasn't changed in all the years that we've been there.
Yes.
I think maybe one more house is visible somewhere in the distance, but it hasn't. No developments and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
It's really quite amazing, Vermont, in that part of the Northeast Kingdom, so-called, is still.
Yes.
It was.
Yeah.
We were in the Northeast Kingdom on a little back road called Paradise Alley.
Oh.
It still is. It's still where the house is. It's still called Paradise Alley. Our address is something Paradise Alley.
It's pretty great.
In the Northeast Kingdom near St. Johnsbury.
It's a little sanctified.
Couldn't get any more spiritual than that.
Right.
Anyhow. My wife now lives up there.
Oh, really?
She doesn't want to be here anymore, so she's taken off. Well, not taken off, but I mean, she's chosen to spend her days up there in Vermont. She's tired of being here or whatever. I mean, I'm tired of being out of what it is.
Uh-huh.
Anyhow.
Yeah.
She's spending the winter now with our oldest daughter. And because it's a little, our house is a little isolated and a little difficult to get to.
Yeah.
Her car half a mile of plowing road, so
yeah.
She's spending the winter now with our daughter, and she'll go back probably in May or late April or something. I don't know what her plans are.
Yeah. I want to check and see whether this is
you do that while I go to the bathroom.
Playing back correctly. Okay. So, the interesting thing that I guess I didn't really quite realize was that you had this extensive design background.
Extensive.
Well, I mean, you were at the Art Institute of Chicago.
I majored in industrial design.
Yeah.
It's called, and it was the only place in the country, I think, that offered such a course. Maybe Pratt did in New York, I don't remember. Anyhow, that's what I majored in, because at the urging of my parents, especially my father, they thought I should be involved in something that would make me money.
But
the
your inclination
of being an artist was not that. You know.
But your own sense was that you were going to be an artist.
Oh yes, I wanted to all my life. My earliest efforts, drawing and stuff, I was always sensitive to that. And when I finished high school, I announced that I would like to go on to art school. My mother said I didn't raise my boy to be a sissy.
Righto.
I remember saying that. But my father prevailed, and he was very sympathetic to what he had wanted to be an artist himself when he was young and didn't have the money and couldn't afford to apprentice himself to commercial artist, which was the only opening.
Where were you born?
In Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
And you grew up there?
I grew up there. I went to school in Chicago, which was close by, so I would go home weekends and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'm very grateful to have been born and grown up in the Middle West. It was a kind of isolation, you know. Milwaukee was considered a cultural wilderness,
mm-hmm.
but it was at least a fresh place.
Yes.
And we had to learn by ourselves, anybody who came from there, like Frank Lloyd Wright, for instance. The school at which I first taught is in connection with an art gallery there, the Leighton Art Gallery, and it was run by two quite marvelous women who ran a school in the basement of the museum. In his autobiography, Frank Lloyd Wright mentions these two women with great affection and fondness. They were the only people ever to invite him to Milwaukee to give a lecture, for instance. You know, nobody cared about that at all. So they were very fine people, and we became very close friends. And it was with some sorrow that I had to denounce I was going to leave the school. And it was rather sudden, because I suddenly had this offer from the University of Michigan, which I couldn't refuse. It paid so well. I was getting a small family together, and they couldn't pay enough in Milwaukee. So that's the last I saw of them. I went to visit them a couple of times, maybe afterward, I don't recall.
Well, did you feel that the engineering training was forced upon you, or...
No.
Did you welcome it? I mean, were you happy about that, or...?
Yes, I was not successful at it because I had too much an artist attitude. And I designed... then, after I left school, I opened a little studio or office or something with one of my classmates. Two of us opened this place in Milwaukee. And he ran around finding some small amount of work for us and designing things. And... to local companies, and I was very pure in my attitude toward design. I would design something for somebody and say, well, I don't like red, or I don't like three stripes, or I wanted three stripes instead of two or something, and I refused to accept that because I felt what I was doing was correct. You know, I mean, I was very much very creative about it all, so that didn't last very long. And I had finally any other supplemented with teaching because we didn't make enough money. And then I never got got involved with that anymore. I became a sculptor sort of by, default. I was teaching at the University of Michigan by that time, as I already said. And the head of the department there was a fantastic man, a German refugee, Fred Hitler.
Oh, really?
He was not Jewish, but he was a very fantastic man anyhow. He hated their role, Nazi business, so
yeah.
He left.
Yeah.
And however, he became the chairman, I don't know, of the department, whatever he was. And
do you remember who that was?
Ernest Munch was his name. Ernest, not Ernst. Or wait a minute, it was Ernst, E-R-N-S-T. Ernst Munch, M-U-N-D-T.
Yeah, like Carl.
Yeah. And he was a very bright and very energetic man, very, very full of energy.
And he was a sculptor?
No. He actually didn't really make anything, now that I think about it. I mean, he was not personally creative. After I began to make some small works there, then he decided he would like to try to do that too, so he did.
Do you think he had been a Bauhaus person, or...?
No, he was not from the Bauhaus.
He
might have been associated with, he was old enough to have been around before the Bauhaus, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know, these dates to...
Well, such as, similarly, Hans Hoffmann had his own...
It was way back, time with all of that.
Yeah.
And he brought to the department a great enthusiasm and a great intelligence. And one spring or whenever it was, he said he was going to put on a show of the faculty work. Well, I didn't have anything. I wasn't doing anything. I had left my office of design, and I wasn't doing anything. My wife was dancing. I did costumes for her and lighting, and I was more devoted to her work than anything I wanted to do myself. I really had no particular interest in that. Something else. So he said, you've got to show something, you've got to make something to show this little faculty show I want to put on. I said, well, I don't really do anything. He said, make some drawings or something, just to contribute to the show. So I made some drawings, and I hated them, but they were all terrible. I threw them in the wastebasket. And as one of them was descending, I remember the experience. I just caught my eye, and I thought, oh, that might be interesting in three dimensions. Just like that. So I snatched it out again, and we're sitting right there now on that television set, my first work. It's a little double portrait of me and my wife dancing together. And I've had to replace that paper because it won't deteriorate, but it's headlines about our involvement with the war in Japan, with Japan, so it's from that period.
And the original strip was just a newspaper.
Well, it's the same as it is now, it's headlines, but it's a newspaper also.
Is that?
Yes.
It looks like a thin bronze material or something.
Newspaper.
Is it really?
I had to replace it because it aged and fell apart.
Extraordinary.
But the first piece I had in there had to do with the announcement of our war with Japan. I was very socially conscious, I guess the word is. And I'm very upset by our involvement with the war. I was a pacifist. That goes way back because... great diversion of your mind. When I was a small child, my father made toys for me. He made everything. He was very capable, very handy about things, and very good. And he made me a little wooden boat like this. I can still see it. I can draw you a picture of it. With dowels for smokestacks. It was very simple, just a couple of oars. And I cared a lot about it, but I floated it once in a while. And then I had some cronies, you know, kids my own age, around, and we all had our toys and were playing with them. They took great delight in smashing up their toys. And they prevailed upon me to attach a string to my little boat and smash it against a brick wall of my grandfather's house where we were living. And I took the remains of it to my father and said, look what I've done, you know, smashed up the boat. He said, well, that's okay, Richard, now you don't have a boat anymore, do you? that hadn't occurred to me, losing the boat. He said, all right, he must have been a very wise man, my father. and he said, I'll make you another one, but I want you to watch me make it, to see what goes into me. So
I'll never forget that.
He was right.
He was a wise man.
So I sat there while he made me another little boat, you know, and he said, I'll never make you another one. This is it, you know.
Yeah.
And you must remember, I can hear him say this. He said, try to remember that you shouldn't destroy anything you can't make yourself or replace. I became an instant pacifist.
Oh my God.
I couldn't kill anybody, you know, I mean, I took it very seriously. I was about 10 years old or something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
So it transformed my attitude toward things that was saying that to me. So of course I never destroyed the second little boat, and I was very careful about everything I had after that, not to destroy it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was amazing that he taught me that. It was very unusual. So I haven't ever been, even though I wanted to kill people.
And then you thought about having to
never succumb to temptation. I mean, there, you know, there were monsters around with that, Hitler and Mussolini and others, or at least they seemed monstrous. And we all wished they were gone, out of the way. Anyhow, that's how I became a pacifist.
So
it was anti-war. I didn't go to the war. I was at the age of being in the Second World War, and I was drafted, but I had already joined a bigger group. They're pacifists, you know.
Yes.
And I didn't do it to get out of anything, but I was sympathetic to their cause, and I enjoyed some of the people I met, the friends I made. They were wonderful people. And when it came time for me to be interviewed, to be drafted, I talked about what I just said to the man who was interviewing me. I said, you know, I can't kill anybody. I just couldn't do this. And I told him, I guess what I just told you about my father had taught me. He looked at me and he said, I wish I could believe the things you believe, but I'm afraid that if I walked away, I would be stabbed in the back. I said, then you'll never get to heaven. I think he was some kind of religious person. I was being interviewed, you know, to determine whether my pacifism is genuine.
Yes. Yeah.
Because they did excuse us for that, so I became a conscientious objector, I guess they
did
called
you?
It. And I mean, you know, they made out of it especially, but I was exempt then, and I was very happy about it because I also had a little daughter in a small family beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And I went on with my work, and not with the killing anymore. That was my attitude.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were, 24?
Yeah, I guess so. I was married when I was 25, so I was 25 or 26.
26, yeah.
At that time.
So you were...
Right after I was married, within the first year of my marriage.
Yeah. But a lot of the boys who were going were 18 and 19 and 20 and so forth, so you
I had been deferred. A number of times. First,
you were a little older then.
First of all, for being married, that was one. At the beginning, they deferred you if you were married.
Yeah.
And then I had a child coming on or were born already, and so I was given a further deferment for that. But eventually, these deferments were all canceled because mm-hmm. they needed boys.
Yeah.
Cannon fodder.
Yeah. Yeah.
And finally, the time came when I was called, and as I've just described it, talked my way out of it. I didn't do it for that reason, but that's what happened.
Yeah, yeah.
So they gave me a status of conscientious objector.
Yeah.
So go to the war.
Yeah. So, and then in this odd way, you made this peace at the at Michigan, and you hadn't really thought about sculpture in a major way. Prior to that?
No, as I say, I was more involved with my wife's dancing than I was with anything I would do myself.
Yeah.
But I made this for that exhibition, as I say, based on a drawing I pulled out of the wastebasket. And it came to the attention of a man named William Ballantyner, who was the director of the Detroit Art Institute. A wonderful man, enormous in stature. He must have been close to 7 feet. And he was a German, kind of left Germany also.
A refugee.
Well, he wasn't Jewish, but he, I think he had
similarly
fled, you know, so many intellectuals did. They just fled.
Yeah.
And he became director of the Turner Art Institute and did very wonderful things there, fine exhibitions and stuff. Anyhow, he saw this little piece, we had been introduced to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "That's most unusual." He said, "Nobody's done anything like this before. You should make some more." And he showed it. He wrote a book, it's still have it somewhere, and based on an exhibition he produced, it was traveling to some of the major museums in America, wrote this little thing. And it was called The Origins of Modern Sculpture. It began with the Venus of Willendorf.
Are you serious?
No, of course I'm serious.
That is unbelievable.
What's unbelievable?
He included pieces that were ancient.
He considered the Venus of Willendorf the first sculpture produced.
Of course.
And you know what it is, the Venus of Willendorf is the prehistoric.
Yes, yes.
And that was the show, started with that and ended up with me.
So he wanted to show the origin of contemporary thinking in sculpture by reaching as far back as possible.
Of course, when you go back to the Venus of Willendorf, you end up in a rather abstract
area. I would say so.
So it was a sort of justification for him of contemporary abstraction. Anyhow, he was very sympathetic to what I did. He introduced me to a gallery in New York, the Willard Gallery. And Marion Willard, who ran the gallery now, at that time, I think, maybe with Betty Parsons, was the first gallery to show contemporary American art.
Yeah, yeah.
Not successfully, but she had an income. In fact, she lived in this very house. This was her estate. She inherited this estate.
Marion Willard? Really?
And, of course, it got broken up after a while. They couldn't afford the taxes on it.
Yeah.
And this was originally an old house, just to divert for a moment. Old Victorian kind of house in around 1950. It was transformed as you see it now. I didn't do any much to it. By a man named Elmer Morgenthau, from the well-known Morgenthau family.
Yes.
And what is my studio out there now, she used as what she called a music shed, commissioned works from young composers. I used to come out here during the summers when she gave these concerts. Wandering around this house, I thought this is how the other half lives.
Yeah.
I had a small apartment in here.
Yeah.
A couple of years later, she died, and the house was empty for a year or two. And we'd barely given away. I got it for very little. We moved in, moved out of the city in 1955. Well, where am I now?
Well, really, so then people like Valentina and Marion Willard really encouraged you to start in sculpture and had a hand in.
I would say so. And Valentina was very, very responsive. As I said, even that little work, he said, I've never seen anything like that before, you must make some more. So I made one more that year.
Right.
And that began things, and Marion included them in those shows. There was some other show that somebody put on. Well, it was Valentina, The Origins of Modern Sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
He based it at the exhibition the book also. I think the show traveled around. This was in it. So that's how it started. I, by default, almost, I became a sculptor.
I mean, David Smith may have been working at this point already.
He was with Marion Willard.
Was he already?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She represented him.
But I'm not sure about other figures. Was Seymour Lipton already working, or Rorschach, or?
Well, they're all of my generation.
Although you were maybe a little bit older than some of them. Well, maybe David Smith was your.
No, David was maybe a little older than that.
Yeah.
But
he was too old for the war.
They were all of my generation.
Yeah, yeah.
Rorschach.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not very nice about appreciating other people's work. And I never became very close friends with any of them. David was in the gallery, as I say, in my gallery, for a while. And all at once, one evening he came and when Marion wasn't around and took away all the books of his that were there. He said, "I don't any longer be in this Sunday school."
Sunday school?
His Marion's attitude was very spiritual. She was interested in Asian art and in spiritual things. She wasn't interested in sculpture, anything for its material qualities, but rather for its spiritual qualities. That's why we got along.
I've never really known that about,
well, that's,
about her.
That's what the situation was. And for David, this was not earthy enough. It's the only word I can think of using. Yeah. He talked for a while. I mean, he used to say to his students, "Put some balls on it, put some balls on it." Which is nothing I would ever say to my students.
Never.
I might say, "Put some wings on it."
Right.
Or do a halo or something. Anyhow, we, of course, knew each other very well. We went to gallery together, but we didn't hit it off with at all.
But you had some relationship with Motherwell and some...
Yeah. Motherwell, I've forgotten how I got to know Motherwell well. To know that mother well. But I think we exhibited together or something, and he became interested. He was a very, very gracious person in helping other artists.
Do you know if he was living on 94th Street already at that time?
Excuse me.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe he was.
I don't recall.
Saga.
That's a wandering saga. Well, we were backtracking a little to the fact that people like Marion Willard had shown your work, and that you had some association with some of the other artists of the time, but maybe it was limited by your own personality and interests.
You've got it right.
I asked you about where Motherwell was living because this rather interesting fact has sort of emerged out of some of these histories, which was that Fritz Bultmann was the guy who taught at Hunter.
Yes.
And he turned out to have lived on 94th Street along with Motherwell, and as it then turned out, Giorgio Cavallon also lived there on 94th, and there was a whole nest of artists on 94th Street.
Artist Walker,
Artist
Avenue.
Yeah. And ended up teaching at Hunter, so it was a sort of a, I think Motherwell,
amazing,
you know, wanted his community around him or something.
Well, I suppose so. I don't, but yeah, he was very interested in communal efforts, not communal efforts, but in sympathetic associations.
Yeah.
I don't know how to put it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, it was interesting. Gene Bultmann gave us an interview in which she said that your successor, Tony Smith, used to live with them on occasion for God knows what reason, I don't know, and spent a lot of time in the bathtub until one day she said to him, "Why don't you go out and get a job?"
Back to the womb, I guess, or something.
Whatever. But you know, what's interesting to me about that is that you said that you were pressed to leave Hunter, and you know, that's why Tony Smith came to Hunter, because there was a vacancy left because of you. Of your leaving.
I think so, yes. I don't remember.
And that's... In a way, an accident. People always think that there was a great design to that, but I see now that there was another element in that picture.
I don't remember having anything to contribute to Tony's succession or anything.
I think that he had been at Bennington, and
right.
And Gene knew him at Bennington, and probably cajoled him into taking this job because the you know.
I really lost contact with Hunter at that time. You know, I mm-hmm. got busy with other things, mm-hmm. And I had no input anymore. So I very little contact. Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly what happened after Goosen or anything else.
Right. At the time, it was mostly undergraduates, and you said you had taught a few graduate students.
Yes, that's how I ended up with two evenings of graduate.
Yeah. In fact, one of them, or a few of them, have spoken to me about you. One of them, Mark Feldstein, still teaches photography at Hunter.
Oh, really?
and remembers you well, and there are a few other people who have written to me who mentioned your name.
Have you encountered Marilyn Gelfman Pereira?
I've encountered her name.
Karp. She's married now to Ivan Karp, the dealer.
Oh, she's Marilyn Karp.
Mm-hmm. Marilyn Karp. She was one of my students at that time, and particularly appreciative of my teaching. We still communicate occasionally, like every 5 years.
I will make a point of contacting her.
She would have a lot to tell you about me.
Really?
I think so.
Yeah.
Because we became close friends, not just student-teacher relationship.
You mentioned this a couple of times, of forming these friendships. It sounds like these people really look to you for mentoring, almost, or...
Well, I think that this was maybe the result that my teaching was, I hate to say it, it was not, I mean, so being more, the word escapes me, my teaching was more to do with living, not with theory or, ideas as such, but the relationship of art to life and that sort of stuff. Which went over very well, I think, with the students because they were involved with decisions about what to do with their lives. And many of them responded to that. For instance, I know that Marilyn Karp's, my influence on Marilyn Karp was considerable. I know that. And it may have helped her with her life. I think that what my teaching did for many people was to... which was my aim, to help them to find themselves, look into themselves, to find out who they were, what they wanted out of life. And this was quite different from academic teaching, you know, theories or problems to be solved. And there, I got a great deal of appreciation from a number of my students for that reason. And I think that I had an influence, not that I intended it, on... self-determination for many of these people, and if that was the case, I'm glad for it if it helped them to be who they became. And I know with Marilyn especially this seemed to be the case. We communicate once in a while, it's every couple of years. Mm-hmm. First thing she says, "Oh, Richard, I love you."
That's so great.
Not in a personal way, but just, you know,
no.
for what I did for her
yeah.
in her life. It was very rewarding, I guess. I never thought much about it, but it was very rewarding.
Can I ask you a sort of a ruminative thing? It seems to me that if you went as a young person to school before the Second World War, and then... did as you did, studied industrial design. And then later taught as you're describing it. That really involved a kind of a revolution when you think of it. Don't you think? I mean, your early training must have been fairly circumscribed or rigid. And then as you described how you taught students at Hunter, it was as much about life as it was really about an attitude towards art
yes,
or an approach. Well, don't you think that it incorporated a radical change?
In education?
Yes, in education.
Well, I never thought about it, but it's possible, I guess. I mean, it wasn't the usual way of teaching. I know that. I remember when I was at Hunter, shortly after I started there, Edmund Lutz sat in on one of my classes. At the end of the class, she said, "That's the hardest way to teach possible. You know, it takes such an effort." I mean, because I was so involved with all these questions and things.
Yeah.
Most teachers handed out formulas and problems to solve. I did that too, of course, but she was very. Which I never did in my life.
Now, just going back to that. To that thought about the change, I guess what I'm curious about is how did you feel the freedom to do that kind of thing at that time, the way that you taught, yeah. And I mean, beside the fact that no one restricted you from above and said, "Oh, this must be your course content" or anything like that, you must have personally felt free enough to take that approach, to do it in that way.
I never thought of myself as a teacher as such. I didn't go into teaching because I wanted to be a teacher.
That's what it is.
I went into teaching, first of all, because I needed the money to be most practical about it.
And yes.
The opportunity was there. And every situation which I did teach, I was lucky enough to have a sympathetic attitude toward my attitudes, like with Edna or the ladies in Milwaukee when I first began to teach. They were impressed with my attitudes about life and about art and relationship, those two things. So I never taught by formula or by rules or whatever. It was very hard for some of my students occasionally to do things out of their own needs, out of their own attitudes. That's not what they expected. They wanted to have formulas handed to them, and occasionally there was some rebellion among my students about that. I was not interested in that. As I say, I didn't set out to be a teacher. I didn't want to be a teacher, especially.
Right, so that there are at least two other elements there. First of all, this other generation that was free in its encouragement of someone like you, and then the fact that you were not pedagogical. You were not coming from that position.
No.
So of course that enabled you to take this approach. I mean, you know, the net effect of that was revolutionary. I mean, that's really the end result of this.
God, I had an influence on education. That was my attitude. I wanted my students. I felt very strongly. I still think I would feel that way. That they should learn about themselves, who they are, where they are in the world, you know, and find the direction of their work through themselves and through their relationship to life as they experienced it. And that's what an artist does, after all. And it's the way I thought they should be taught. Give formulas. I hated that idea.
Yeah.
Still do.
Yeah.
You can't, at least in our time, you can't formulate everything.
Oh, no.
Maybe
no.
You could in the Renaissance, you know, you can't. No.
Right. Well, I mean, the end result of this was that really their education totally changed in that era, in the post-war era. It utterly changed. Well, actually, one thing that's come out of our research is that Harold Rosenberg was a pretty astute observer and wrote a piece very early on saying, these people are artists and they're entering academe and they will forever change.
He was right, I guess.
And that that had both a negative and a positive
connotation.
Exactly. Yeah. That it, perhaps its effect ultimately on art also could possibly be negative. I think I've already seen some of the results of that. You know, unfortunately.
I understand what you're saying.
I think your day was.
It was, yes.
There was a blessing in your being able to do what you were able to do.
Well, as I said, I never thought of myself as wanting to be a teacher or being a teacher.
Yeah.
Just something I had to do.
Yeah.
And I did it in the same way that I would make my work, by addressing the problems of living. I only wanted my students to open their eyes to themselves and to the world and be alive in it. And that was very difficult. Most students, even the brightest ones, were all hiding the security of some place in life, you know, that they'd been told about, or you understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
Or brought up to believe in, or something like that. And I was trying to shatter all that and make them face themselves and find out who they really were. If possible. Of course, I suppose one could say it was my own problem at the time, but I was not aware of that. I was often accused of being extremely self-centered and vain, or whatever, because I was so secure in where I was and what I wanted to be and what I wanted to do. Maybe not always being able to realize it, but I had no self-doubts. Still don't have them, and I guess that's something I wanted to find fault with, but it also has got me through life. And what it has done, the thing I appreciate most about my attitude, I'm trying to be objective, is that with this detachment, I'm able to appreciate everything that's presented to me and not prejudge it or judge it in terms of my own personality or my own needs. I suppose it's inevitable to some extent. But I still look upon life, although not as much as I used to, with wonder and with delight in the things that I observe and find. They were certainly the basis of my work when I was young. And I think that that's a very valid and exceptional gift to be able to do that, to see that, to lose oneself in that. I look at the work of many artists now, I get magazines, sculpture and stuff, and for me so much of it is, it's either too conceptual, they're thinking so hard about what they want to do, or you know, what to make new, or whatever, or it's totally self-description, and I'm not really interested in it. In the description that people make of themselves, and you know, I mean,
well, you see, there's a very interesting difference between what you were talking about, which is a kind of a discovery of the self, and a self-description, which people are very involved in now, where they almost illustrate themselves. It's almost an illustrational process rather than a process of discovery.
It doesn't interest me what other people are. I mean, in general.
Yes.
Who knows anything about the personality of the carvers of Chartres Cathedral, or
exactly,
or even you? That is the Renaissance. We don't know much about their personalities. They didn't do it to illustrate themselves. They had a job to do, and it's just almost like a workman, you know.
Yes.
And I respond to that idea. I've never in my life, I can honestly say, thought that what I'm doing now is a picture of myself,
yes,
illustrating myself.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, that is, hasn't been of interest to me. And if I look at the works of the past that I find so exhilarating, I'm not absorbed in the personality that did them. For instance, I'm very fond of music, and I particularly like the works of Johann Sebastian Bach. And I don't find in his work anything that reveals the nature of his life. He had a very rough time for many years. He was stuck the last years of his life in Leipzig with a very low salary. He had to teach 7 classes of Latin to little boys, things that had nothing to do with his being a great composer. He was not even appreciated as a composer. Nobody thought much of his music, but they valued him as a virtuoso on the organ. That was his reward, if you want to put it that way. And yet he's one of the great composers of all time, one of the great artists of all time.
It's amazing to think of that contradiction of the situation and what we now have of him.
I know. He was forgotten for 200 years. Nobody remembered him paying attention to him. I think it was Mendelssohn and somebody else who finally said, you know, that Bach was their father, father figure.
Well, it's when you look at it in this way, it's an extraordinary span of what you've seen from your origins to from the time that you were first involved in art, let's say, to this current kind of state. I mean, it could dismay you, but there's always a danger of succumbing to too critical an attitude, I guess. And I think it's great if you keep your.
Well, as I said earlier, I'm really grateful that I grew up and was brought up in a part of the world which was a cultural wasteland. I had to find my own values, and it's quite different from a kid growing up in New York waiting to be involved with museums and artists and everything else. I think that must be rather confusing because you know what is meaningful to you. I suppose you can find some sympathy with some particular thing. But I know I had to pull it all out of myself because there was no help, you know, in the environment at that time. And I still feel maybe that I'm more dependent upon nature than I am upon any cultural manifestations.
Yeah.
I adore, I'll hug a tree.
A tree hugger.
I'm a tree hugger.
Oh, dear.
Well, I don't do it very often.
And not in public. Yes, but you did take those first students out on a walk, you see.
That's right. Yes,
you.
Yeah. Well, that was more to get them to open their eyes to something.
Of course.
I think that's the first job of an artist. If you're in the visual arts, you got to keep your eyes open. If you're in oral arts, like a composer, you got to be aware of all the sounds that come your way.
Of course.
Both man-made and nature-made. And this is the job of an artist.
Yeah.
Me.
Yeah. 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 Well, I do think that you were part of a revolution. Whether you did that consciously or not, you did influence.
I think so.
I do think so very much.
I thought about it.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. It's great for me to be able to see the continuity when you speak of some of the figures who were there, some of whom I knew, and then you speak of other people who were your students, and I've spoken to people who were your students. I can see the line, and it's great to be able to trace that, you know.
Well, that's sort of your job, I guess, what you're writing about.
Yeah. I'm enjoying seeing that a lot. I wish very much that Hunter would have a great monument to you. Or something. Municipal institutions tend to just forget their wonderful connections. their, you know, the people who served them.
Of course, when I was there, I wasn't so well known, and I don't think that the institution itself was that appreciative. I'm pretty sure revised that, because Edna certainly was.
Yes.
And so was, what was his name, who was the president? Schuster.
Yes. George Schuster.
George Schuster.
Yes.
He was very appreciative.
Yes.
And I gave a couple of talks, public talks, while I was there. He was very responsive to those. He used to quote me. The language I used.
I saw some of those noted down, and the titles they were.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they were serious lectures of that would be a credit to the institution today. I wonder if they're. Do you have old papers and things of that period, by any chance? You wouldn't ever have any of those lectures or notes or...
I didn't write them out. May have made just some reference notes, what I was going to say. But I've never had any problem with finding words when I needed to find them. And most of the talks I gave were impromptu or, well, I don't know what other word to use, it's a bit spontaneous.
Right.
Based upon a general idea, which I had, but
right. There
were elaborations on that idea, and that all spelled out.
Well, they were things that you were thinking of at that time. Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for this. This was interesting, and I
hope it didn't wander too much.
I know this will be an invaluable record for the people who are going to be hearing it. Oh, definitely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Who else are you interviewing?
Sorry?
Who else are you?
Well,
we're all dead, most of us.
No, unfortunately. Jean Bultmann just has done a tape.
Who?
Jean Bultmann, Fritz Bultmann's widow. And Leo Steinberg, who maybe came a little after
yes,
you.
Yes, he was.
I've talked to Bill Rubin, and he is going to do something, but he's involved in the same kind of effort for the Museum of Modern Art at the moment and has to get that done first.
Right. He's the director now, isn't he?
He was, and he's now emeritus.
Oh.
And
thinking he must be very old.
And is complaining mightily about being without a secretary and having no help and so forth and so on. So I'm going to shut this off so the transcriber doesn't go on forever. So at the Art Institute of Chicago,
one of a very important teacher was a man named Emil Zettler, Zettler. He was, first of all, a very unique personality. He drove in a car that nobody else would have driven, and he dressed, you know, more like Franklin, right? I mean, uniquely. And the greatest contribution he made to my education was one little thing. I tended to be rather effusive, baroque, about my ideas about what I was designing, incrustations of all kinds of things. When he came along and looked at it all, he took an eraser and erased all my incrustations.
Oh my God.
And it got down just to the basic form. He said, "That's a very beautiful, well proportioned form, and that's all you need. You don't need to do all this." I remember that that had a great influence on me.
Of
just
course.
That observation.
Of
his
course.
Erasing and stuff.
Of course.
But the daring he had just come along and erase some of his work. But I never objected to it. I saw what he meant, and it set me on the right path of being basic, you know, essential about things, you know, irrelevant junk. So that was very useful to me. He was a very good guy. I was lucky to have him as a teacher.
I talked one day with a painter who's now older named Norman Bloom. And Norman said that he had been at the Art Institute of Chicago that on the top floor, this was about 37, Niels van der Rohe had set up an architectural studies office.
At the Art Institute.
On the top floor of the Art Institute of Chicago. When he first came from Germany, maybe it was earlier, 36 or something like that. It was quite early. And he studied architecture at the age of 18 or something, or 19, up there. And that he was so exacting a teacher that one day when Bloom was doodling around on his sheet along with the drawing of exactitude, van der Rohe came over and said, "Oh, I think no." Mr. Bloom, that you will be a very good painter, but a very bad architect. And from that day, he dropped architecture and became a painter. Well, I think that teachers in those days sometimes had a very direct telling kind of influence on people. They were truthful and helped to steer people in often a good way.
Well, as I look back upon my education at the Art Institute, all the teachers were professional people. There was not a single one that had a degree in education, you know.
Yeah.
And it was just there carrying on, theoretically. There were all people doing things professionally.
Mm-hmm.
And that gave great life and validity to what they had to say.
Of course.
Came out of their experiences. And that was very good, I think, as I look back.
Was Zettler a designer?
Yeah, you know? he was sort of a designer. He designed a very famous tea kettle.
Really?
As I remember.
Really?
I have a very simple one, sort of flat on top and sloped a little, and a very fine handle for that.
Uh-huh. Long before Robert Graves did his.
Yeah, I think so. Anyhow, that was one of the things he did. I think he designed some furniture. I don't recall too much about what he did. But he was a professional. I think those are the best teachers because their experience comes through, you know, and what they teach. May not want to accept what they do or what they've done. But that's beside the point. What is important is their experience and what they've learned about things themselves. Because that helps you to find the way to learn. That's what I would have hoped my own teacher did.
Well, and what you're saying suggests that there is a longer tradition of this. Than is immediately apparent in higher education.
I don't know what goes on in higher education today. I have no idea what goes on in education today.
Well, actually, things have become more stratified and more structured. You can't teach in a college without an MFA, and I think that this, for example, in the graduate school now, there's a very, very heavy emphasis on reading, a tremendous amount of the French philosophers, the current postmodern, so forth and so on, and less on self-reliance, so less on self-investigation. So it's become a little bit dry and a little academic to my way of thinking.
Well, I was involved with that a little bit because after my first year or two at Hunter, Edna suggested that I would be more apt to be promoted and stuff if I had a higher degree. All I had was a BFA from the Art Institute of Chicago. So I took a course or two and turned in a master's and found it very tedious, boring. I didn't want to be part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But meanwhile, my own work was becoming more well-known, and that led me to finally a full professorship based on my professional rather than my academic education.
Yeah.
So I was fortunate, I guess you could say, in that.
Yeah.
I didn't need to spend my time.
It may have been through Lutz and people like George Schuster that this was accomplished in the hierarchical City University, which I think was in other areas much stricter about credentializing.
What it is like now, you're teaching at Hunter, aren't you?
Yes.
And just wondering what things are like now. Are you teaching studio courses?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
In what? In sculpture?
In drawing. And graduate students in painting. I'm a painter.
I see.
So mainly those areas. And I used to teach printmaking when I first came there. I think the printmaker who was there when you were there was Gabor Paterdy.
That's right. That's right, he was.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah. And
it's not so long ago.
It is a while. There was also a man there named Harry Stinson. Do you remember him?
Right.
Little tiny guy?
I know.
Yeah.
Very
sweet. Yes. And then there's a name here that keeps popping up that I don't recognize. Albert Heckman. Do you have any recollection of that man? Do you have any idea? Did he teach drawing or
Albert?
Yeah.
Well, the name is vaguely familiar, so way in the back of my head, the farthest possible position.
Mm-hmm.
The name has some resonance, but I can't remember anything about it, precisely what he did. may have been in the department, you know, teaching drawing or something.
Right.
I don't know.
I forgot to ask you this question, having just looked at the little first work. Did you think at all of Calder in those days, or was he in any way influential
I would say
on
not.
You?
I mean, people have suggested that.
But yeah.
I liked his work. I was interested in it already as a student, I believe.
Yeah.
This is another generation almost.
Yes.
But I never thought that I would try to do things like him, or in any way be influenced by him.
Yeah.
And I think that our work is very different. I mean, from my point of view, it's very different.
Yes.
I honestly can say that I really was not influenced by Macaulay. Just as I wouldn't say I was influenced by
Picasso,
Francesca. You know, I mean, I liked all of them.
Exactly.
Things, but
yeah.
I wasn't directed.
Right.
I didn't try to do things like Macaulay.
It almost doesn't seem as though you tried to do things like anyone. In a sense.
I hope not.
Well,
no, I wasn't trying to do it like anybody else.
You weren't really following.
I did find myself and what I wanted to do. And I don't know where that came from. Maybe it was from my family background, what I got from my parents or something.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been more interested in learning directly through observation and through my relationship to what I see. And I have never felt that I could do that through anyone else's eyes. They're not my eyes.
But it didn't even really occur to you to work off someone else as a counter or as a change from someone.
No, I never thought of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I thought only about doing things and I thought I wanted to do as problems suggested themselves for me to solve. No, I can just say I didn't think of what I was doing in relation to anyone else. I think it's rather unusual. And people have tried to associate me, say with Calder, you just did. But my attitude toward what Calder did was something that I was not interested in.
Mm-hmm.
What he did, I thought, and I liked it and all that, but it was not something that for me would have any validity.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't follow in that direction.
For you to do that.
No,
for him, fine.
that's it. Mm-hmm. As with every art that I like, I mean, you know, I'm not diverse to other people's work, but it's for them, for me. Most I can say is that I appreciate work that bears a rather direct relationship to the moment in which it's created. I can still say with impartiality that of all the sculptors of this century that I can think of that I like, it's Frank Lucy. He was the first one to lift things into space, the magnificent bird, which I was exposed to at the Architecture Institute. And I think in a way I've carried on from there. I haven't done this consciously, but my work is incorporates a great deal more space than Frank Lucy ever did. But, but it was a gesture that I thought was very fine. And of course his forms are so beautiful and so essential.
Extraordinary.
And, you know, I still appreciate Frank Lucy a lot.
Yeah.
I think he was an honest and marvelous man. He was sort of a peasant, but he had a marvelous natural sense of beauty and proportion and all the things that make a good work of art.
That's
a natural thing. You can see that in the work.
Yeah.
It was not studied, it was not labored, it was just what it was.
No.
So I still like Frank Lucy a lot. I respond whenever I see him to what it is. As I say, if I have any relationship to it all, it's that I feel maybe I've gone beyond it as times have changed. Mm-hmm. That's all I can say about him. He's the one sculptor of this century that I really think was terrific.
Yeah.
Can't really think of anybody else.
Yeah.
Yeah. Calder is fine, yes, but some others for me in Calder, the sensitivity or whatever that there is in Frank Lucy. This isn't a total thing, it's much more playful.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
It's humorous, there's a lot of humor in Calder, and I think that's fine, it should be.
But there's a force in Brancusi that is extraordinary.
It's nature rampant.
Oh, yeah.
It's almost sexy, all the stuff in there. It's so natural.
Yeah. Someone said, I don't know if this is true, that as a young man, when he was starting out, that he walked from Romania to Paris or something like that.
That's,
I mean, that's so...
It's possible it may have taken 3 years.
Who the hell knows?
By which time he might have wished he hadn't done it.
Well, maybe that was his, you know, his Vandayara. He learned.
You learn a great deal by walking.
You can indeed.
That's how I started out. I wanted to take my students.
There you go. Full circle. Okay.
Well, I was so delighted with Vermont, and I enjoyed walking around as much.
Yeah.
And observing the forms of nature, and the minutiae, and the, you know, the big trees, and everything. So I thought something that students might learn from as well.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I have.